Though Dasha's life was certainly exceptional, it brings to light the lives of individuals at the edges of empires of their times, fighting for a cause about a distant place while embroiled in and consumed by the politics of another place. It is for that reason that individuals like Dash show us the wide range of Indian nationalism, but they also show how entangled within that variant of nationalism was the history of the US and Canada's transformation from expanding settler states to partners in imperial surveillance. Studying Dash is important not only for digging out yet another individual from the dustbin of inter-imperial history of the period of the early 20th century, but to explore the entangled history between expatriate patriots like Dash, expanding settler states, and claims made on behalf of a nationalism. The task of fully exposing and exploring these claims, and the ways that empires of the present understand those claims, in the midst today of resurgent populist nationalisms in spaces like the United States and also in Canada, remains the job for the future of the study of Indian nationalism, surveillance, and empire, once the lives of people like Dash are fully uncovered. That's it. Thank you.
Wow, thank you for a real tour de force and a very detailed paper. I've got tons of questions, but I don't think it'd be fair for me to dominate. I do have one. Did they ever find him and revoke his citizenship?
They did not. They tried very hard, and then so one of the things that they did was deny him visas. So he tried to get a visa as a U.S. citizen, and he couldn't get one, and then he, in a sense, illegally leaves. But when he came, so this happens in 1925. So he left without a visa, and then when he comes back after 1946. And so at that point, it's okay for him to be a citizen and to come back. So even with the best intentions of the U.S.'s deportation and denaturalization program, they couldn't do it. By the time he was back, the laws had changed.
Does his American citizenship cause any problems for Indian citizenship post 47?
Yes, and so that was a question. So he one of the speeches that he gave in Calcutta, they asked him if he was an Indian citizen, if he was a U.S. citizen, and he was very insistent that he was a U.S. citizen, and he didn't see himself as an Indian citizen. So.
First, a marvelous account of a very, it's of him, but it's also, if you will, of a world that he was living in, the early immigration. And I presume there are other chapters in this book that deal with him after 1925,
yes.
When
yes.
He taught at Columbia,
yes,
and
he
had some sort
yes.
of role. And presumably, you mentioned that most of the similar figures were not so, quote, pro-American.
Yes.
I rather thought that maybe they're not writers, but people like J.J. Singh and the people who are, this is the India Committee, which is the big pro-independence lobby,
yes.
or one of them here, that they were generally, I mean, that he could have had problems in Calcutta in 1952 or 53, or even perhaps in 2018 is quite possible because of the fact field. But I thought that
yes.
a lot of them had that kind of orientation.
Yes, actually, yeah. So I'd
maybe they didn't write books as
yes.
an academic.
But that's absolutely right. So many of the people that he was around and the Friends of Freedom, the Friends of the Freedom for India, this organization has started late 1910s, and they're close to all of the people that you mentioned, the organizations that you mentioned. They don't explicitly write in this way that he is, but they see the United States as a model, and that lasts throughout the period. Another thing that you mentioned that is also important that I didn't mention here, he briefly comes back in the 1930s, and again, under the radar. This is an interesting historical set of mysteries here, but he shows up and he starts the Taraknath Dash Foundation, which is still in existence. And it started in 1935, and it's registered in D.C., and it's notarized in Ohio. And he has a whole network of people who...
Are they the people who give the Taraknath Das Prize
yes.
at the American Association
yes.
of Asian Studies?
Yes, they are, yes.
Uh-huh.
So that was started then with money that the Mary Keating Morse family had, and that it's registered in his name. It's still in existence. It's handled by Leonard Gordon, who is a retired faculty member at CUNY Brooklyn College. So it was based in Columbia University, where he had taught when he came back. And they held the funds, and they were the home of this organization. And it was started to help support Indian immigrants in the United States. And some of you may know this story, but you know, Omar Bhosh, his father, came to the United States and said that the only person that I know of here is Tarak Nath Dash. And Tarak Nath Dash allegedly showed up and helped him. And through this foundation, people like Omar Bhosh's father and others started their life. And also it contains scholarships that they still give out to Indian immigrant students. They do other things. They recognize every year they have a Tarak Nath Dash Award recognizing the, you know, the most prominent scholar who works between India and the United States. And they recognize organizations that are, you know, social service organizations and arts organizations and other things. Anyway, the formation of this organization was with others who also share the U.S. as this idea of a model for the future of India, even though at that time Indians were not able to become naturalized citizens. In the 1930s at that time.
Fascinating talk. And also, I'm actually fascinated by Tarak Nath Dash, who seems to me, you know, the fact that he was able to, on the one hand, be very nimble about being in various spaces that seem contradictory. For example,
yes.
I mean, he was the victim of the exclusion
yes.
acts, but he was working in the Immigration
yes.
Service of the United States. He clearly must have felt certain amount of racism and so
yes.
forth, but at the same time he was seems to be devoted to the U.S. American
yes.
project. How is he, you know, in your from your study of him, how do you look at him as a sort of a, his own emotional and kind of how does he, I guess, reconcile all these things? I mean, you don't know, but just wonder. He seems. There are a lot of contradictions in the way he lived, it seems to me.
Yes, yeah, I think that, so at one level, the allegations that followed his life since he started working for the U.S. Immigration Service are worth thinking about. Many thought he was a double agent, and
right.
because of that, he was able to always slip under the radar who really was responsible for Dash. So there's something to that. On the other hand, also, I think he perhaps could have genuinely believed in the ideals that he understood the United States to be supportive of and wanting the United States to live up to them. Now, his marriage to Mary Keating Morse is an interesting one because at that time, formally, her citizenship was also under scrutiny because white women, if they were to marry somebody who was ineligible for citizenship, would have their own citizenship potentially revoked.
Oh.
And now, he was, you know, at that time, he was 40, she was 60, she was a very prominent activist. He moved in various circles, and that her family and her access to different kinds of networks enabled his work as well. And so there's many different levels of his life. I think there's a possibility of him being genuinely committed to some of the ideals he mentioned, as well as potentially being supported by a number of institutions and not just a sole individual agent.
Well,
I wanted to ask this particular idea. In his work, actually, as you mentioned, there's this inspiring experience, you know, of the United States Republican values, and then later on, I mean, I'm asking this about his work and the legacy. How does that? I mean, but obviously, as somebody who worked that much in the United States, and then you know his legacy, I mean, how if there is any legacy in Asia, how does that impact their view of the world, and also their relations? I mean, the relations with the West. Is there any war going on in terms of all that, or
in terms
I'm
of
curious about that? About the legacy of this war. Whether people in academia or students or people exploring international relations there? Is there something in terms of legacy there?
Yeah, so I think there are two kinds of legacies, and both of them are issues I explore in the broader project that I'm doing here. One is that there's a discussion primarily in Canada, but it occurs also in other spaces, like somewhat in the United States, somewhat in Australia, and this is a discussion around the impact of Asian migrants on indigenous peoples and displacement of indigenous peoples and their role in the creation of Canada, US, Australia. So the discussions have been that, well, are Asian migrants settlers just like European settlers and claiming a space for themselves just like European settlers had, and thereby also contributing to the same relationships with indigenous peoples? That's one. And Tariknath Dash enters into those conversations in Canada now. And that's one kind of legacy. Another one is whether or not the histories of Asian migrants should be uncovered to understand the nationalisms of Asia, nationalisms within India. And the latter is becoming much more of interest in India, the nationalisms of people outside of India, and how that relates to the really detailed politics on the ground in places like the United States. On the first part, I would say that the contemporary discussion in Canada around Asian migrants is aiming to integrate that discussion with an awareness of histories of indigenous peoples, of histories of settler formation, histories of displacement, is to include Asians into that history. That's what currently is happening.
Thanks.
My student, by the way.
Okay.
So I was just curious, you mentioned in your presentation that both Dash and Gandhi mentioned that India could also potentially be an imperializing race after the British left,
yes,
perhaps. So, and you also mentioned that he was very insistent on his use of Hindus to talk about everyone who came from Hindustan. And that was distinct from what the U.S. dictionary talked about earlier, right?
Okay, so that part, the latter one, is not so much his choice, at least for Dash and for those in the United States. So as we know from the Bhagat Singh Thind case and others, that then that's post-1911. So after 1911, the official term that the United States government used was this term, Hindu, which meant from Hindustan, which covered all the different groups as they saw Hindustan.
Okay.
And that was not Dash's choice.
Okay. I see. So I was just curious if there's any underlying Hindu nationalism, as we understand it today, in his thoughts, and if his idea for imperializing Iran and others,
yes,
was the Akhand Bharat idea, which was being floated in the 20s,
yes,
and 30s.
Yes, that's a very, very important issue and obviously very relevant for the contemporary situation of India. So I would say there's two issues that sometimes get mixed up that should be distinguished. So one is that in the North American theater of politics, the term Hindu in the early 20th century is not the same Hindu that is being discussed in the context of Akhand Bharat, in the context of Hindu nationalisms of India. So these are parallel conversations, but they are not taken from the same set of politics. So the Hindu that comes out of the Dictionary of Races of the United States is something the United States has created out of its own understanding of the world that Indian migrants are stepping into. And Dash, at that time, is not a part of what later becomes Hindutva politics in India. However, these streams converge, and so my last chapter of this work discusses this moment. When Dash comes to India, and it's a brief trip, and it's mostly the fact that his relationship to the United States is the issue, but he, like many of his generation, and like many who were outside of India and not fully, in a sense, aware of politics in late colonial India, extremely opposed to the idea of Pakistan and extremely opposed to the partition of India. And the manifestation of his understanding of this opposition to Pakistan starts to acquire a Hindu identity in India. So when he comes to India and he's seen in a certain way as a member of the U.S. partisan side, he then says, but I believe in a Hindu India. And it didn't happen. this belief in Hindu India is something that comes from a different history than those within India who had created this idea. But they converge at that moment. They can be appropriated in a way that is ahistorical after the fact, because Dash doesn't come from this Hindutva Malyu. It's only after the creation of Pakistan and partition that he is. So those are two separate histories that come together.
Yeah, since you spoke about his education at Georgetown and his degree in political science, you also mentioned that Levin worked and met with anarchists and Germans and so forth. I was wondering, what are the intellectual influences on him? Did he read Marx? What shaped his ideas?
Yeah, so there's, I think, two sources. So these moments of encounter in the prison space, which of course in so many other contexts are very powerful, it's that. So he got to learn about socialist radicals in prison, and he got to start to read about them, which we don't have much evidence of that before he was in prison. But most of his sources are other Indian nationalists like Krishna Varma, who was a very devoted reader of Spencer, and he, Dash, is reading The Indian Sociologist, which is being sent to him, and that's one of his biggest sources. And he then later starts to read Marx in the 1930s, but there's no evidence of him, like many of his Indian colleagues, assuming Marxist positions or being a socialist in any way. But he comes to that later in his life. So the major set of sources are other Indian nationalists and what they take from European politics, as well as what he reads in political science and in his schooling, which would have been, you know, diplomacy of that moment of the 1900s and 10s.
Tanvi.
So I just had a question about, as the gentleman said, the legacy of Bharatnath Das. And I was wondering if there are any discourses coming out of Germany about Bharatnath Das, and if there are any discourses within Indian political parties about his legacy, or and how it's shaping your research on him.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, thank you for that. There is. I didn't mention this, but another part of this project is about that element of his life. So when he's in Germany, he's there from 1925 to 1934 with a few detours, but by and large during that time he's in Germany. And he, along with others, starts an India Institute there to help Indian students who are in Germany at that time, and to invite Indian intellectuals, people like Rabindranath Tagore and others, to come into Germany and to share aspects of their views of Indian culture and history and politics to a German audience, and for those Indians to learn German and to have access to German society. So, and this started in Munich, and this institute is not in existence anymore, but it is the origin of later Indian student organizations in Germany. And this part is well documented and highlighted by the Indian diplomatic presence in Germany. So he's seen as an origin point for that. And then in India, the idea that wherever he went, so US, Canada, Germany, he's very much concerned with Indian students and their faiths, and he starts scholarships for them. This is something the Indian government also recognizes. There's a Tariknath Das Center in India, though not very well funded, but it's still in existence since the time that it began in the 1930s.
Yes, so I had a question sort of going off of which you asked. So now Dash was exposed to radicals in prison, and I mean, maybe before that, working with Indian migrants, specifically in lumber and in shingle making, was a very high union density job. And so, you know, he met with a lot of radicals, he read Marx later in life. My question was, how exactly did he sort of fit his appreciation and admiration for the United States within all of this? The U.S. system being, you know, very, very capitalist, for lack of a better term, especially, you know, after 1945 and all that.
I think, yeah, I mean, there are different moments in his life when he's exposed to and working at different registers. When he first gets into the Pacific Northwest, and as you mentioned, and as I mentioned in the beginning, his world is the world of the edges of the United States, and so there are small numbers, but visible numbers of Indians, young men mostly. There are women, but the first jet waves of these migrants, almost all are men. And they are trying to make their way, you know, very much like East Asian migrants a few decades earlier. And in his own memoirs and a few others of his time, there's quite a lot of reference to how he's becoming aware of the U.S. system and the Canadian system, but he's also very much touched by how wherever he went, so in different parts of Oregon, Seattle, where he starts his education, there are various individuals who took him in, who are very thoughtful about how they engaged with Indian migrants, professors and other students at the University of Washington. And this theme carries forth throughout his whole life, really, that in the United States he was, even though there are these ideals that are not attainable, or they're not attained in his lifetime, the actual people of the United States, wherever he went, seem to be quite supportive of him. And then, when he gets out of jail, he makes contacts with various intellectuals of various types, professors and other public intellectuals, some of whom he knew from his jail time, who were very eager and active in helping. And this is another facet that he felt really spurred him on to promoting the United States, a place where there's this opportunity, for lack of a better term. And he's reading political science about diplomacy from the beginning of his educational career, and so that layer, that the idea that India can be an independent state, the United States as a model for it, and that there are various nice people around who help him. This is something that almost all of the Indian migrants of the period, Lal Lajpat Rai also writes about this, and other Indian professors, there's a few in the interwar period, one Shunindra Bose in Iowa, and he writes about this as well, that even though the ideals of the United States are often not attained, the actual practical experience of being a student or a professor in the United States was very positive to him, and many of the people wrote like this.
Yeah. I'd like to follow up on that, because I wrote about this in 1990 in Foreign Policy, that the United States should try to spread democracy by its example. And I once asked Carl Gershman, the head of the National Endowment, about this, because he was promoting a more forceful democracy promotion. And he said, no, that's too passive. And just this morning, I'm reading an article out of China, and the ideological response to the United States. And it said, the United States has been promoting these color revolutions to destabilize. We have argued that China has walked back the pro-democracy because there's something wrong with China. Chinese are saying, we are becoming more suspicious of you because of this. This might be a useful debate at a meeting. What are the virtues of this approach? Because I'm struck by what you just said. You know, the students, professors coming here, the power of the American example. Because we are now getting real blowback, I would argue, internationally, from our effort to spread democracy more aggressively.
I think that's probably more a feature post-1945 and then post-Cold War global geopolitical circumstances in the United States in the 1900s to the 1930s, which is when this is all happening. The geopolitical situation is obviously not what it became after 1945. And I think unlike the 21st century, when Indian students, professors, and those who were spreading throughout the Pacific Northwest, there wasn't any sensibility around what they were there for. There was no sense that they were there to. There is the kind of threat or the kind of understanding of democracy or non-democracy. I don't think that was in the air around Indian migrants at that time. So it opened up a different space of interaction, intellectual, political, and otherwise, that I think doesn't occur after the 1945 period. And there's also not an Indian, I mean, there's the lobby for India, the way that India is understood in the United States after 1945, that did not exist in the early 20th century. I think there are many other kinds of openings for these sorts of interactions.
Yes, you also mentioned that Sudash read Tolstoy's and Gandhi's works about how the biggest Indian problem was not colonialism, but the mindset about religion and violence.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if there are any accounts of how he was impacted by it, and if he tried to do anything in these two areas about religion and violence in India.
Dash.
Yes.
So Dash, from that, on that note, I mean, as we know from the history of Gandhi's life, you know, in that conversation, Gandhi and Tolstoy are very similar. So they come to a similar conclusion that India's problems are within the mindset of Indians, and Dash is coming at it from a position before that conversation. In his revolutionary days in Bengal in the 1890s and 1900s, this conversation would not have taken place, and he sticks to that pre-Gandhi view around the British Empire. After that, he does discuss religion throughout his life, and this is another theme throughout his life that I explore to some degree, that he does identify India as a Hindu space, very much like V.D. Savarkar does. And when he's in jail, for example, in Leavenworth, he lists his religion as Vedantin. So he, and throughout his entire life, he writes a book about Tagore, in which he says that Tagore, this is Dash saying that Tagore tells us about the religions of India through how Hindu religions, and he uses the term Hindu, can encompass all of India. So they're all almost these proto Hindutva elements, but he's not attached to those politics. This is just him as an individual who doesn't get to the Savarkar point, doesn't get to the Gandhi point. Again, in the U.S., in a very particular context, is he saying these things. And in violence, he does. So in the context of, he writes a lot about Japan and Korea. He's very fixated on the rise of Japan. And of course, is Japan a menace to Asia? The answer is no. Japan is a power that is checking European aggression. And he writes about, like Tagore, who was very critical of Japanese aggression and violence. Dash, less so. And Dash writes throughout the 1930s that Japan's aggression and violence is no different than European aggression and violence. It shouldn't be seen as something that would be critiqued in the same way. So in that regard, he's different than Tagore or others and their positions on violence.
All right, well, I'll take the last question, if that's all right. So you've got a couple of different stories of the politics of place going on in this, and obviously the politics of imperial place and the politics of national place. The one that kept striking me is the politics of region, which is where you are now, the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could, or if you even want to comment on that, because on the one hand it seems like it's just the background to your story, but on the other hand, it does seem a very peculiar and particular place, especially at this time. I mean, the density of networks and the politics of this space is very particular. You know, the fact that he's running into these unionists, these IWW types and everything. So I wonder if there's a story there to be told.
I think that it's perhaps more than a coincidence that the landscape of the Pacific Northwest, the very recent in his time, the very recent settler expansion into those regions, and the fact that there's a need for laborers in high numbers everywhere he goes, from different parts of Washington and Seattle to different parts of Oregon to different parts of California to BC. All of these places are places where, when he's there, indigenous peoples have been very recently dispossessed, and Asian laborers from other parts of Asia are also being scrutinized, curtailed, they're reducing in numbers, and there's a great need. And this, and the landscape of the Pacific Northwest as a place that is not the urban places that he had been more attached to in the East Coast and in his other travels, I think all of those combined to make that Pacific Northwest a very powerful place for his growth, development, and politics. Yet he mentions it on a few occasions, but I think to him it's really a part of his overall political education and life, that this is, that forms just one part of the bigger story for him.
Great. Well, please help me in thanking our speaker for a wonderful paper. And I think goes without saying, we're all looking forward to the book.